Jason, what's up, dude? I feel like you've been a point of conversation in and around the Overlook Theater for about, holy fuck, how long now? What, Straight Edge Kegger came out in 2019, I think.
Yeah.
Fuck, that was five years ago?
Good math.
So our former third chair, Justin Coote, which I love it whenever I start off in any of these shows talking about him. He's in a hardcore band called Alcatraz, and his dream...
They're big in Japan.
They're huge in Japan. Actually, I think he just played a sold-out show in some weird area, and they're going on a South American tour soon. Somebody dusted them off the shelf, and they're back. But yeah, so... His dream, he always talked about it, trying to get you out at the Balboa and doing like a one part screening, other part concert. And I'm like, as a fan of music and film, it sounds like a perfect marriage. Yet as an event coordinator, you're like, it's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
And those crowds don't always get along. One is very high energy.
Yeah.
One might be introspective.
That was my first question. Yeah. What kind of crowd are you bringing to this thing?
Well, what do you think the proper lineup would be?
I don't know, because again, me coming from comedy, it's like comedy and music. Typically, that's a tricky background. I mean, it's the same
thing. But you would go comedy, then music. Right?
Because in most situations, yes.
Yeah, didn't David Cross like tour with Tool?
Except, I mean, you do have a couple of outliers like Cat Williams, I would say.
Where you would do a band.
Where Little John performs with Cat Williams. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, his stand-up has, you know, evolved into.
Have you ever done anything like that, Jason? Played the film with a band?
We did that for we did a couple of things, but one, when we premiered in Lafayette, like the town that I live in, we had a few bands play after the movie, and one of them was Ugly Bones, who kicks off the movie, cause they're good buddies. So yeah, that was a great time, but I think you're right. It was like probably half of the crowd cleared out after the movie cause they didn't care to see a show, especially a hardcore show. But then we got like a new group of people that came in just for the show. It was a great time. There's a group called, Numbskull Productions out your way. I think they're more in LA actually, but they set up some screenings and I went to one in LA where we just did the movie, but I know they did another screening where they had bands play after, and I just couldn't make it to that one. It was my dream to like tour the movie around and do it that way. But like you said, it was kind of like a logistical nightmare. And
yeah.
And we didn't ever make enough money at the screenings to like, you know, pay the bands. And I also don't want to ask people if I could avoid it. I don't want to ask people to work for free.
Yeah. I think the way you'd try and alleviate that is let them sell merch. The problem is that they're two different crowds. And if you get a band crowd showing up to a movie, they're going to be drunk and not paying attention. Or I don't know. What kind of crowd do you get for your film? Do you get like straight edge?
We don't need a pit in the second act.
Yeah, but that's curious because my problem was always like, I know Anvil played out here at the Castro with their movie. Or we saw the Residents film with the Residents.
But I mean, it was the most boring movie paired with the most boring concert. So that, and you know.
We had venue seating watching a film. So our head was at a 90 degree angle the whole time. It was a fucking nightmare.
It was awful.
The best.
I'll take the hit on this.
But if you remember, fucking P-Lander Z played with...
I miss that show.
Mad Tiger.
Yeah.
But they were different days. So it was a little room at the DNA Lounge. And then the next day it was at the Roxy, the movie. Perfect pairing. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm curious. So again, I don't want to spend a ton of time on Straight Edge Kegger, but we've been talking about your fucking film for like 4 years. So we have to. And also, we're doing the world premiere of Looky Loo, so I don't know how much I want to spoil that. But
sure.
I'm curious how the straight edge culture, like hardcore culture, received your film. Because I've known like Randy, ex-straight edge here.
Does Jason know that Randy is the straight edge ninja? Did they have that conversation? That's
right, dude.
This is news.
Randy, you didn't introduce yourself as a straight edge ninja. God damn it.
I didn't know. It was like... In late high school, I made a short film with some friends called The Straight Edge Ninja, and I was the titular ninja.
What? That's amazing. I wish I would have known that. We could have like paired that. That could have played before Straight Edge. Still
Randy, send him the movie. Randy, send him the movie.
I'll see if I still have the link.
Oh, what the fuck,
Russ,
is that?
You still have
now,
it?
Hold on. By
you
the way,
have it, right?
We have a Discord and we've been teasing, showing shit like that. Everybody's connected to some weird little film. Randy's like, no, we can't show that. My friend won't let me. But yet you'll shoot him a link immediately.
It's called networking, dog.
My God. Also, let me go ahead and out Randy. He used to be Straight Edge. He's not anymore.
That's a pretty common thread. That's not everybody, indeed. But I have quite a few friends that were Straight Edge and now they've moved on at least a little bit from that.
So what's your relationship with the, what do you call it? Ideology? I don't know. Code?
Edgeness?
Yeah.
Are you down with the edges?
Yeah. So when I was in eighth grade, I had a brief brush with pills and weed. And I got expelled from school at the end of my eighth grade year. And I was like, I was always a really good kid in school. I got great grades. And then, when I'm like a skate rat. And so like we started, just starting to cause all sorts of trouble. And so I got expelled for a stupid situation in school. And so I didn't do anything drugs or alcohol related until I was in college. And then it was just alcohol. So while I wasn't straight edge, like I wouldn't call myself straight edge. I was practicing the same things that they do. And so I think if you go back to like Ian MacKay's statements about it originally about being productive and not just wasting your life away drinking or taking drugs, I totally agree with that. I love to stay productive more than I love to drink, but I also like to drink. So, and I went to a few shows where I had brushes with, some edge crews where it was like, we were just trying to get people into a mosh pit to have fun or like a circle pit. And then like, I remember getting punched in like the bread basket by this guy. And I actually, funny enough, I didn't have a single drop in me, but I think he thought I was just a drunk guy who was like causing all this chaos. And so I ran up to him and was like, what is the problem? And he wound up like backing off and we were fine. But so I just thought it'd be interesting to take like the hardline straight edge thing that happened in the 90s and take it to a more extreme place for the movie. And truth be told, Straight Edge Kegger, the original plan for that movie, it wasn't called that. I just wanted to make a punk rock horror movie. And I thought the easiest way to go was neo-Nazis. And then as we're starting to mess with that, Green Room comes out. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, how do we still make a punk rock horror movie, for our teenage selves, but do something different? So that's how it came to be.
Dude, I could feel that while watching it. The way you shot it, everything, you took a more like highbrow route instead of like leaning into the tropes or like getting really like, I don't know, scummy with it. I don't know. Like, and the whole time I'm like, fuck, dude, like Green Room. It feels like right there. When did Green Room come out? Like 2018?
Yeah, something 2016, 2017, something like that. Well, so we shot the proof of concept trailer for Straight Edge Kegger in 2016, somewhere around there. Yeah. So like maybe we knew Green Room was coming out. I don't even remember the timeline. I'm probably mixing up my years, but yeah, as we were starting to plan it, we knew that Jeremy was going to release his movie and we're like, okay, we got to pivot a little bit,
Well, coincidentally, didn't you also have Patrick Stewart attached to your project as well?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. That caused a lot of controversy as well from what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Straight Edge Kegger, I thought it was really interesting because I was unaware that I was straight edge. And when somebody told me I was, All I knew is that I had to be, I'm a contrarian. I can't help it. That's why we do a fucking found footage film fest. I have to be different. I have to go against the flow. And I didn't drink until I was like 22. And I remember very clearly, I was working at Roundtable. This dude's like, man, you should get X's tattooed on your hand. And I was like, that is the dumbest. What the fuck are you talking about? Why would I do that? And he's like, because you're edge. I'm like, I don't know what that means. But when he explained it to me, I immediately was like, oh, no, I'm not a part of a group.
Somebody grab me a beer.
Yeah. Well, no, because, but I was just like, don't ever call me that because I don't know what the fuck that is. And also, I think I got a crack in the armor there. And then I started drinking Smirnoff Ice. I think.
Oh, wow. Later that year.
Oh, the perfect gateway.
Oh, yeah. I jumped right off the cliff. But I didn't even know what it was. And then I met a ton of hardcore kids at one time, and I learned all about it. Yet I feel like the most nuanced conversation I ever heard was in your movie. And I mean, our buddy, you know, we love Justin, and I always tease him about it, but he is, it's not a joke for him. And I don't think he's like
a joke to us.
His nightmare is that he will go to a restaurant and his virgin daiquiri will have liquor in it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you ordering a virgin drink? So there's a part where like his wife drinks, but, and he daydreams about killing people who try to slip him alcohol.
Oh my
God.
In
the beginning of your movie, that happened, and it went a very different direction than I imagined, where a couple of friends just bonded over alcohol. And so did you have a buddy who was straight edge? Are you like venting anything here?
Oh yeah, for sure. And a part of it's because I don't want to out him. Right? I mean, he's publicly not straight edge anymore, but I still don't want to out him. But I've had a close buddy, film partner, who was like really agonizing over the decision to break edge. Like,
oh
yeah, he didn't want to do it anymore, but he had built up this like importance around it because everyone knew that he was straight edge. And I just, you know, we had many talks where I was just like, look, I don't care if you drink, don't drink, smoke, don't smoke. Like, I really don't care. But like, I don't think you should be worried about what other people have to say about you. Like, you should do whatever the hell you want to do. And all he wanted to do, to be fair, like, was smoke some pot so that he could just chill out because he had such bad anxiety. And it totally changed his life for the better. So I think if you just let people do, as long as they're not harming anybody, you let people do whatever the hell they want to do, everybody would get along a lot better. So
is Henry Rollins listening?
Well, here's the problem with a lot of straight edge people. They are very preachy about it. So I would imagine that if I was very in your face, like put that beer down, which a lot of them aren't, like Randy wasn't, but I would imagine that you would fear the roasting that would happen when somebody's like, oh, what happened, dude? You were going to punch me over a fucking shot now.
Well, Randy, you know, Randy comes from the music world. So Randy, you know, has been touring this great country of ours on a bus while people were shooting dope food between their toes.
Yeah, right.
Randy's seen it all.
Randy, also, you can't leave. Never. I also never had, experimented with anything at all before. I pretty much in like eighth grade or so, I heard Minor Threat and I just was like, oh, straight edge seems cool. Then was straight edge till I was like 29. I was like, I don't know. I kind of want to like see what's up with drinking a beer once. And then
with these hops, everybody.
Hold on. Let me out Randy. I remember this very clearly. Randy, this is part of why I love you. You heard some fucking podcast. I think it was Conan O'Brien or something. And somebody pointed out that coffee is as much of a stimulant as any other drug.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It fucked I remember you being like, I think that's right.
Yeah, I thought about that for years before I actually started drinking alcohol, too. So I was like, I don't know. Kind of, you know, it kind of, the straight edge wore off like in my mid-20s. But it took a while for me to actually start drinking. Exactly.
Yeah, you know, coffee's not only a drug, it's like the best drug. That's why I'm drinking it right now, and I plan to continue all day.
Do you guys know the band AJJ or Andrew Jackson Jihad is what they used to be? They have a lyric. I'm totally going to butcher it, but they had this thing about edgers in one of their songs, and they said, but they're getting high upon self-righteousness. Oh. And that really struck me, like, because I totally support people that are edge. Like, I think you should, like, but it's that ideology and like shoving things down people's throats. It's kind of like with religion. Like, I don't care what your religious affiliations are, as long as you're just a good person, you're not trying to shove things down my throat. And if you do, I'm going to give you some stuff back. Like, you know, so that's really where I'm at.
Everybody's bringing their own shit to the table. You know, and everybody's looking to plug these specifically shaped holes. And we're all just trying to do what we can and hack through the jungle with dull machetes like everybody else. You know, but sometimes, yes, back to your point with religion, it's like, yeah, that's the problem with Christianity is more than anything. It's like they have a marketing problem. That's Christianity's problem. They don't have to market correctly because people get annoyed.
I gotcha. You think the Jehovah's are better?
Oh, that's not a good marketing plan either. Yeah, it's not great either. Door to door. Hey, we got to move past that. Go, maybe go by like email scamming. That maybe would work better for religion. I would look into phishing and things like that.
Fish? Oh, fish. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not on a river.
That could work out. Randy, write these ideas down. We'll work on them for the next episode.
So, Jason, I'm curious. So, when you tour your movie, do people come in bringing their baggage and then they watch it and they're like, this isn't what I wanted? And then do you have to hear about it?
That's so funny. So a buddy of mine who didn't start as a buddy, like I didn't know who this guy was, but we went to this film festival, Genre Blast, and and he, I don't think he'll mind if I out him, but Brandon Lescure, he's an indie producer, and he came up to me after the screening and after I did my Q&A, and he was like, I got a level with you. Like, I am straight edge and I came into your movie expecting to hate it. And I actually really enjoyed it. And he said, and I actually, during your Q&A, I realized that you don't actually have any animosity towards, you know, my belief system. You just wanted to make a horror movie that had a punk rock background. And so I think that's usually the response we get when people give it a chance. But I think a lot of people who feel very strongly in their beliefs and they're kind of set in their ways, they just look at the poster or the title and they're like, fuck that movie. Like, I'm not going to give it a shot because I think that they're mocking my way of life. And while I understand that, I wish they'd watch and realize that, like, we're not trying to do that. We really could have gone way more silly and like mocking their way of life. And that wasn't what I was trying to do.
Yeah, I had a different preconceived notion. I thought that it was going to be okay. So I would align more with like the metalheads than I would the hardcore kids. And I, you know, I look down on them. I'm like, put a solo in your music. What are we doing here? And I think the same way about punk horror movies. I think of like Trauma, and I'm like, okay, let's learn how to make a movie. Like, what are we doing here? And so when I thought Straight Edge Kegger, I, you know, my gut reaction is to roll my eyes. I'm like, all right, here we go. It's going to be a bunch of drunk fucks who are going to get put down by the paladin of the clear-minded. And I was shocked at how, like, first how well you shot it. And then also just the way you approached the subject. So I honestly, I bet you introduced a lot of people to Straight Edge. So if anybody out there was concerned with the way you treated it, you probably introduced a ton of people who would have never heard about it to it.
I also hope so.
Yeah.
We had some people also that were like, that they didn't understand certain things in the movie because we didn't want to like beat people over the head, exposition. Like, if you read the original screenplay, I had these segments that were like SLC Punk break the fourth wall and give like his story. Yeah. And when we shot the movie, we knew we were going to do that stuff last. And we didn't even attempt to shoot it because we got to a point where we're like, we don't need that anymore to finish this flick and tell the story. But there are some people who are like, I had no idea what you were referencing. It's interesting. Like, actually, you know, what's funny. This is not Straight Edge related, but you have no idea how many people didn't understand the Edward 40 hands. The girl in the bathroom.
Oh, that's funny.
Dang.
They were so confused about that. We did like a scorecard at our very first screening in Italy. And especially there, they were like, "What? Who is this? What is happening? Why did she duct tape these things for me?" Yeah.
So have you ever done that? Have you ever done it?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's hardcore. You know, that was always a game that we would threaten each other with playing. Because first off, when you opened up and you were talking about like kind of the idea of straight edge, just don't waste your life just getting drunk. I definitely did that for 2 years. But it's also the 2 years that I kind of developed my palate for cinema because we would just get wasted, threaten each other with Edward 40 hands while watching Gummo. And then at some point I'm like, you know, I think I'm more into these movies than hanging out in this garage. And sure. We never actually did it. Have you ever done it?
No.
You went to college. You never did Edward 40 hands?
No, I'm a gentleman.
That's a lie. So, fuck, how do you... You have to have a friend duct tape you up, right?
Yeah, usually we do it at, like, a big party. So a bunch of people aren't... you know, my house, the house that I still live in, I actually wound up purchasing this house, but since you've seen Straight Edge Kegger, like the living room that's all graffitied and stuff, that's my house. And so we kind of wrote the movie to the house, and like we've chilled out quite a bit, but like we've had a 2-foot mini ramp with people skating as a concert's going on, like in our foyer. Like everything used to be, it used to be kind of a wild party around here. Mostly punk shows. And so, yeah, we would come up with all sorts of games, like whatever we could possibly throw at it. The Power Hour thing. We would do Edward 40 Hands, and Edward 40 Hands is a real shit game to play, because when you're done with that first 40, that second 40 is just warm. Like, so yeah, you're just struggling there. I don't actually know that I finished both 40s before being unduct taped. I think I probably failed every time, but it's been years. I wouldn't do that nowadays.
So what do you have to do? Like, is there a safe word? You're like, when I say this, get them off me.
It's just begging your friends, like, please don't make me do this anymore. That's all. Or like,
Tim Burton was a safe word.
Or you could be real deceptive and you could like go into the backyard and like pour some out, come back in like, oh yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. So you live in like fucking Burnt Ramen or something. Like, did your house have like a venue name?
Yeah. So everybody just called it Tinkler House, because we live on a street called Tinkler Street, and everybody just like laughed at the name anyway. But yeah, so everybody's just always called it Tinkler House.
So did you like ticket at the door? Like, were you charging people to come in?
No, we never did that. We would always just throw free shows, and then like people could
Tinkler House, dude. Get your shit together.
Wait, are you there right now?
Am I at that house?
Yeah.
I've lived in like almost every room. We've had like almost 20 roommates since because I've lived here now 14, 15 years. I rented it for 13 years from like a slumlord. It's an old Victorian house. And so, yeah, it's gone under many iterations, but the house is all mine now. And we're actually about to work on a new mini ramp outside. So we're trying to keep having fun.
How'd you end up getting the house? Did you just like off the landlord and you're like, oh, wrestling rules, I own it now.
How's your water tank? You got tankless?
I started just kind of poking the bear. You know, I was like, man, like I didn't expect to live here this long. I really like wish we would have done a rent to own agreement. And he was starting to consider selling, because he owned many properties. Yeah. And so just because he kind of became, I don't want to, this is way too kind, but like he is a little bit of a father figure to me. Like, okay. I have my dad, but he kind of wound up being like an uncle or something. And he's always been very supportive of us and granted us leeway to do what we wanted. So yeah, I actually got the house at a steal compared to like what the market was doing. So that also made it possible, because I by no means am rich.
So it's a very kind gesture from Uncle Tinkler.
Whom you referred to as a slumlord right before this.
He is. I mean, he knows that. Like, we had a storm like a decade ago, and a huge tree fell from our neighbor's yard into our yard, and it broke the fence, and it covered like 3/4 of our backyard. Luckily, it missed the house. And I called him and was like, hey, man, there's a huge tree in our backyard. And he's like, okay, just let me know when you want it gone. And I was like, well, like now? And he's like, yeah, just let me know when you need it gone, you know? And he just kept not doing anything until I finally had to borrow a chainsaw from somebody and cut it up myself.
How fun was that?
It took a long time. But
what did you do with the wood?
We wound up burning a lot of it. Like, we cut it into smaller chunks, but then we also had somebody who came and took a bunch of it away for free. So that was super helpful. Yeah.
What kind of tree was it?
Big. I don't fucking know.
Tree talk.
I'm not a tree guy. What can you do with the wood?
That definitely is a question that I would be like, what, people know trees? And then everybody around me would be like, yeah.
I can't believe we're talking about my downed tree at Tinkler House right now. This is funny. Why? This is not how I expected it.
Welcome to the Overlook, our friend. This is what we do.
We get to the heart of it, man. Have you ever seen the fucking gate? There might be a portal under that root.
That's a metal movie.
Okay, Well, here's the thing. You made a movie about music and you did a great job. And it's kind of, you know, all senses, traditional film, highbrow, yet you're doing a home invasion movie. And then you make a hard pivot. You surprise the fuck out of me when I see that first thing that I liked about Looky Lou, everything lowercase and a hyphen.
That's right.
And, you know, in the in-world camera genre, you always get like a utility title, like footage 2130. And you're like, that's not a movie title. But that's that lets me know that I want to watch it.
It also makes it sound British.
What? The one?
Looky Lou.
Oh, Looky Lou. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
But all the lowercase, dude, I'm like, okay, what is this? And then it's like from the director of Straight Edge Kegger. I'm like, no way. And you made what I would refer to as a hard format movie. It's the one, you know, you wake up my inner contrarian and I'm like, only found footage fans will dig this movie. And how the fuck did you end up there? I mean, I'm very happy you did. But how did you make this turn into, like, hard turn into in-world camera?
So there's so much I want to say about this. But I will say, I do hope that people will give it a chance that aren't just into found footage. But I think what we did, there's so much. So just so you know.
We got time. Go ahead.
We were planning on this being a trilogy. And oh, so
I love that.
So that was, like, the plan from the beginning. And I've never made a sequel to anything that I've done until this. And so we're in pre-production on part two right now. And the idea is that you're going to watch this guy get new skills as both a murderer and a home invader and a filmmaker. And he sees himself as like the most talented filmmaker there's ever been. So in part two, the idea is that it'll be slightly elevated and feel more cinematic, but it is still going to be all his POV. We don't want to leave that. You know, we want to keep that format the entire time and stay committed to that. But funny enough, the project itself actually kind of came together by accident because we wanted to go back. Like my very first film was a mockumentary. So not found footage exactly, but same thing.
It counts.
Yeah. And so I was like, look, we have no money. Like we never have money. We never have what we need. But we were really like trying to figure out like what the next move for us was. And I did want to make something that actually freaked people out. I've never made a horror movie where I tried to scare people. It's always like a genre mashup. And we tried to have more jokes and fun than just a scary movie. So this one, I really wanted to creep people out. We had a totally different plan. We were going to do this found footage movie in the woods. And it was going to be like a play off of the hashtag van life craze. And so like our tag was going to be hashtag van death. And we had this whole totally different thing, but we started doing camera tests and I started just walking around at night by myself at like 3 a.m. and just filming my surroundings. And we started testing all the lighting. And then we started being like, you know, there's something creepy about this. And my writer, Nolan, I kind of pitched him the remake of Maniac, like maybe we can film a POV movie. And he misunderstood that. He thought I was saying this guy's filming his surroundings and becomes a killer. So the idea kind of came from neither of us and both of us at the same time. And that's how we found it and just started playing with it. And then Nolan really dug in and wrote a pretty detailed outline to finish the movie. But yeah, we do know that it's kind of, it's demanding of its viewers. You know, we do know that. It might be a hard sell for some people at first.
I think you've made the perfect type of movie for us, though. Not just because it's, you know, what I call hard format, but it's very cinematic. And it's the type of in-world camera film that is like, it's just, I imagine it living on Amazon Prime or something. And it's just, you usually don't get the best, I don't know. You don't have an audience who's glued to their seat with the music up loud, not fucking with their phone. So, you know, one of the first things about doing the Unnamed Footage Fest was we're kind of bringing movies into the theater that may not have a life there or ever in their director's mind ever planned on playing in a theater. So I think yours is going to look fantastic on the big screen.
I really hope so. I mean, we've done a bunch of tests in some theaters. And yeah, like we, it's hard to know, you know, in the wake of a film like Skinamarink, right. Where they shot this thing with $15,000. It's super grainy and doesn't, if the grain doesn't even make much sense, but it just looks cool. And they wound up making $2 million and partnering with IFC Midnight. And so we're like, when we made this, we knew this would be a tough road to go down. We knew it would take a long time, but we were hopeful that, that somebody could see the value in it. And see that there's kind of like a more, there's a deep narrative hiding, you know, beneath the surface of this film. And I think it's probably going to take part two for us to really prove that to people. Like part one, as much as we love it, is going to essentially be the film within the film for part two.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that some people who maybe won't give part one a shot will like part two and then go back and watch part one to see where it started.
You know, it's going to be great. You're going to come out and you're going to get a completely distorted reaction from the film. Because they, you know, our little like family out here, they eat this kind of shit up. So it's going to be interesting. And you're going to have to follow up when you start touring this around. I imagine you're going to submit it to more film fests, right?
Yeah. And we, you know, we've got a few other festivals after you guys lined up, like Horrific Hope and Scares That Care, which we're very excited. Both of those are charity organizations. So we're pretty excited about that. But yeah, we're not sure what the festival run is going to look like because we have a feeling that many judges are watching the film and being like, this is cool, but I have no clue how this will play for an audience. Like, I don't know that it's worth the risk of even programming this film. And we just kind of had to make peace with that. Like, of course I want to play, I would love to go to Fright Fest in the UK and all that stuff, but we know it's a hard sell. So we're very excited to come to you guys, like not trying to, you know, suck up here, but like we are very excited because it seems like
we can replace you at any minute.
This seems like the perfect crowd for this movie. So I'm really excited to, because and I hope I told you guys that Lev from Ugly Bones, who's in Straight Edge Kegger, he's coming with me. We're gonna have a blast out in San Francisco.
Yeah, you are. Are you coming out for the whole thing or are you like popping in and out?
I come out Friday. So we'll be there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we leave Sunday night. We fly back Sunday night. So I actually think we might have to miss Horror in the High Desert 3. I gotta look. Actually, you know what's funny? I hope he doesn't mind, but I actually reached out to the filmmaker Dutch, like
to Dutch. Yeah.
Yeah. I reached out to him just a couple months ago before we even were selected to your festival and just said, hey man, like I just watched your first installment. I didn't even realize you were making these sequels. Can I pick your brain? And we had like an hour long phone call and hit it off. So I'm really excited. I get to like go hang out with him and our movies are playing at the same festival.
Yeah.
He's a sweet boy.
Yeah. Dutch is incredible. Also a drinker. But he hasn't been lately. Okay. So he's like, we got to shut down the bar if I'm closing. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, but you're flying out. What the fuck? Also, you're in Lafayette in what state?
Indiana.
Oh, God, I thought you were in California. I was like, how the fuck have we fucked this up and not had you out?
No.
I wonder what Lafayette in Indiana is like.
Well, ask him. He's right there.
No, I mean, that's why I wondered if you had a venue name, because I'm like, how did Randy not know about this? I thought everybody out here, because there's such
Randy played Tinkler House.
Randy, never?
No, I do. I am familiar with Numbskull Productions, which you mentioned 30 minutes ago, though.
Yeah. Very nice people.
They're out of, well, I don't know if they still are, but I think they did a lot of shows in Fresno when I was playing gigs.
Yep, they did, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know Numbskull. Well, okay. Jason, are you a found footage fan or do you just keep end up making movies in the genre?
So long as it's good. Yeah, I love found footage. I actually I grew up on Blair Witch, like the original. So that's a big one for me, but I love most, you know, from FUBAR to You know, I love Horror in the High Desert. I love all that stuff. I actually just watched for the first time. I don't know how, I've never heard of this, Exists from 2014. Yeah. I don't know how I never heard of that movie, but we just watched it a few nights ago and we loved it. So no, I am a fan.
Did the Ed Sanchez Bigfoot?
Say that again?
It is, right?
Yeah.
Is it Ed Sanchez?
Yeah,
that's what it is. But yeah, I love that stuff. I even, a few years back, me and the now fiance, we went out to do the Blair Witch Experience, where you go on a tour of a bunch of the filming locations and stuff. So yeah, I'm a nerd for all that.
I want to do that. They tore down the house at the end of the movie, right?
Yeah, I actually, not at the end of the movie. It wound up just like kind of falling down, I think. But they took us out there, and I actually have one of the bricks from the Rustin Parr house.
Oh, that's tight.
You had to like, everything just looks like, you know, just overgrown. Like you can't even see that it's there, but he just took us to the spot and was like, if you dig, you could still find like bricks from the house. So we just like dug under the ground. I actually wound up cutting my finger open and like bleeding on my brick.
So, oh shit. You're not supposed to do that at a ritual site, dude.
Jason, I want to go back to, you know, you talking about, you know, this being a Looky Loo being part one of a 3-part, you know, series that you're trying to look into. What, obviously, you know, this being part one of that, you had to map all this out. So obviously, you know, it sounds like that there was a, you know, script involved, but how much of this first, you know, film is scripted to what we get? And, you know, because, you know, we're moving around a lot, and it seems, you know, just kind of get into sort of your approach with everything.
Yeah. So we did a few different things. So we had very specific scenes that we knew we wanted to do. And we also knew that we wanted it to sort of like scaffold up, right? Like we didn't want to start at a 10, mm-hmm. which may be a hard sell for some horror fans. We're like, we wanted it to appear that he's just documenting the world around him.
Yeah.
And you don't really know what this is going to turn into. And he's like, so like the audience is kind of discovering that he's a killer as he's discovering that he's a killer. Like in theory, he could have just kept peeping through people's windows, breaking into their houses and looking through their things. If he didn't like accidentally wake this woman up and then kill her, who knows how long it would have taken for him to discover that he's a serial killer. So that stuff we knew from the beginning. But then there was a lot of improv. And a part of that is just because we don't have the money to get the locations that we want. And so, for instance, there's an entire scene with Kelly where we rented from like a Vrbo. And, you know, like the photos, they did those almost like fisheye or panoramic views. So we thought we had so much more space and thought the layout looked different than it did. So then you get there and you're like, well, none of the stuff we had planned worked. So I called my writer and I explained to him, I showed him some photos and I was like, hey, does this make sense? Does this make sense? And we just kind of played as we went along. And sometimes we had to improvise just because the doing effects all as attempting to make it look like it's one shot is a nightmare. That allowed for a lot of wiggle room. And my favorite thing about making a movie like this is that it is kind of segmented. Like we could shoot a scene and then say, okay, part of that worked, part of it didn't. Let's go back and reshoot what didn't work. And because you can jump cut, because obviously this guy's got hundreds of hours of footage in theory, mm-hmm. you got to chop that up to get it down to a feature length film. We wound up being able to kind of like watch the whole cut of the film and go, okay, did that actually play how we thought? Nope. Then let's go back and redo something. So there was a lot of improvisation for sure, but the outline was pretty specific. Part two is like a script. It's not a traditional script. There's still room for improv, but it's more like a 50-page outline. So it's much more detailed, and it's a little more purposeful in the things that were the seeds that we're planting, I guess.
So when you say improv, and this is interesting because I think in a lot of context, with film, you know, when you hear improv, the first thing you think is dialogue. But in this film, you know, it is quite bereft of dialogue. So I'd like to know, like, how much did you have that kind of that didn't make the that kind of sits on the cutting room floor here? Because, like, you know, with that sort of what did you sort of lend yourself to with this sort of dialogue-less improv?
It's a good question. we didn't really wind up cutting a whole lot of time. We have some extra stuff with, like, Courtney, the main girl that he's obsessed with and ends the movie. Like, we had some extra stuff with her on the phone that we didn't wind up using because we thought it was maybe it seemed scripted, you know, like, oh, she's saying the perfect line so the audience knows about this killer that is in the community. So we wound up shooting quite a bit that didn't get used. That's for sure. But our logic is that, like, there is other footage. There's even probably other kills, and there's probably other embarrassing moments that you don't get.
Well, also theoretically, didn't mean to cut you off, Jason, but, like, theoretically, like, you know, with all the stuff that you've shot, I mean, couldn't you reuse some of this in part two?
You could. I don't think so. So here's the tricky part.
I'm just trying to save yourself a couple of dollars here, Jason. Yeah.
So here's the tricky part is, and I think you would have to watch the movie twice or be a cinematographer to really recognize this. Mm-hmm. But in part one, he uses the same camera the entire film until the very end. That the scene at the end, I don't think this ruins anything for anybody, but the scene at the end where he's on a college campus and he's filming somebody different. That is the first time that we're using a different camera and a zoom lens. The rest of the movie, it's the same camera. It's always on a fixed lens. So the logic is, well, now he's improved his tools. Like he sees himself progressing as a filmmaker.
Gotcha.
So in part two, now we can get a lot closer to people because he has better equipment and he's actually zooming in and looking at these people up close. Another thing that was really tricky.
He levels up.
And the idea is by the end of part three, he's leveled up quite a bit. I don't want to go there. I don't want to explain that.
Don't. You know, honestly, I'm fighting my, there's two parts here. I'm a huge found footage fan. Obviously I love all of them, but I'm also like trying to protect your film. And I think with a lot of fans, less is more. And I think you did a fantastic job with your storytelling here. One thing that I love about your approach is you're hyper aware that he's the editor. That can be completely lost on people making a found footage film. And then it kind of breaks the very simple immersion of, oh, you know, if you don't pay attention to who edited it, a lot of the times you're like, why is it edited? Like, if you all just died, did you all just get the perfect shots the whole way through?
Yeah.
Like, everything's very clean. But I want to recommend a couple of movies where I think they did, like, exemplary character editing. Descent into Darkness. Have you seen that one?
I have not.
So, much like the title, okay, Descent into Darkness, my European nightmare. It's like, okay, yeah, it's going to get dark. That movie does get dark. And as it's happening, the one who's helming the camera is having like a mental breakdown, and it's reflected in the editing style. It's one of the most like perfect examples of being aware that the protagonist is also, you know, the creator of your film. Then there's another movie called There Inside, which the horror community fucking rejected hard. And the thing is that dude, man, it's edited by a character who is, you know, that's kind of a spoiler, but if you've been listening to this show, you know it. Watch that one. They're inside. And just know that I think they had a similar problem that you'll have where you come in and people are going to have a feeling immediately, but they don't realize that, you know, they're playing the fiddle to your composition because you're very aware. And I love the way that your movie ramped up. Also, I got to ask, you have like fucking 25 interior shots of different houses in this movie. In my head, I imagined, okay, you're a music guy. These are all just your homies. And I loved it. but it's starting to sound like there may be a lot of Airbnb play in here.
We only did one. And it was just because the actress that we found was down in Indianapolis and she didn't drive. And so I was just like, look, I don't want to make this a big pain for you. Let's just find a place that'll work. Rest, it's all homies. It sucks because we kind of tapped. We didn't tap everybody, but like, it is kind of hard to get people, especially with children and pets, to like, hey, can we relocate you for a day or so? But yeah, almost everything in there is just friends' houses. Even like Courtney, the one who we keep going back to her house and she winds up in the chair.
Very happy and full life.
Exactly. That is her place. And so, and she has an awesome dog. And so we had to like have her, boyfriend who's awesome. And we had to have him like take the dog for a couple hours to just like go on long walks and take the dog to get a pup cup and stuff while we're in there, like filming this chaotic scene and scaring the cats. So yeah, it was very interesting.
Break anything in anybody's house?
No, we are very careful with that. Not only because we don't have the money, but we just want to be as respectful as possible. So, you know, I abide by the maxim, like you got to leave stuff better than when you found it.
Yeah,
so
great.
So we were very careful with people's things. The only places that I'd ever risk stuff like that is like my own house, my own stuff or something I brought, you know, but no, we didn't break anything.
Accidents happen.
You know,
they do.
I'd be worried about it nonstop.
Well, here's the thing. Also, the movie called for a dude who is kind of like frogging. You know what I mean? He's showing up and he doesn't want you to know that he's there.
Yeah.
So that helps. You're not like fucking up houses or it doesn't call for you to like smash a TV.
Right.
But I have to say, one, thank you for using real people's houses. I'm a voyeur and I think that's part of the reason why I love this genre. And I was getting like Cops vibes, like where even if you're not interested in what our character's doing, there's eye candy everywhere. Because you could just look all over this real kitchen.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, okay. Because, you know, fuck, man, we watch a lot of indie horror movies, and you can tell an Airbnb, and you can tell when the director's using their house. And you're like, fucking take your Friday the 13th poster off the wall, man.
Oh, like, yeah, that's nothing- actually... with the girl who... checkerboard floor in the kitchen...
Yeah.
So that is the house of my special effects artist, Arissa. And that girl, I went to her apartment and it looked too in the world, you know. She didn't have like a Friday the 13th poster, she had kind of like this goth, like black lace stuff all around her bed, and she had like I don't know, like a Metallica poster on the wall. And I was like, I think we need to find something where it doesn't feel like I just asked all my friends to be in it.
Good. So, thank you.
Yeah. We are as careful as we could be. And, you know, if you want to see like where the like lack of budget really impacts us, it's like in Kelly's scene, the only place that we got a Vrbo, it's the cleanest place. And like, we have a rationale for why that is, but like if we had more time and money, that whole place would have been set decorated like crazy, but we just don't, we just couldn't make it happen, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause normally I would be like, it doesn't really matter, but your film is so, we have such a like open frame the whole time that I could understand why you might want to set deck. It didn't stand out to me though.
Good.
So
That's our plan. You know, I think we still set up enough stuff to make it. You know, actually, I have a cool story about that. Like, we kind of like somebody just asked me the other day, like how I relate to the killer, which is like, it's like a terrifying question to answer. But you know, that idea of like being by yourself, trying to make a movie and like putting yourself in harm's way to make this thing that you think has artistic value. Like, I can relate to that side of it. And a good example of that is that was the one Vrbo rental, right? So like we didn't contact the neighbors. And so I've got a ski mask on at night filming a girl eat Chinese food like through the window. and the neighbors are behind me pounding on the kitchen window like, hey man, stop. And so I'm holding up my gimbal trying to keep getting the shot. And I'm picking up my ski mask and turning over my shoulder, being like, it's okay. It's okay.
We're friends.
Like right after I got the clip, I ran inside and we hung out by the window together eating food so that they could see like everything's okay.
When you say they're knocking on the window,
Stockholm syndrome.
I imagine a whole nuclear family like at a window, just like rapping
people. There were like three, like it started with one woman and then she must have got other people's attention and they're all like going over there concerned. Yeah. So
that's hilarious.
That's interesting. I imagine
I'm glad I didn't get shot or like arrested or something during the making of this movie.
You know? It'd be a different movie.
There's a lot of ways you could deal with your neighbor being filmed by a ski masked individual at night, and knocking on the window telling him stop is probably not the route I would go.
Probably not. But I guess they thought like I would just see them knocking and just run away, you know. But instead, I kept filming.
They're almost like change your life. It's not too late. You don't have to be arrested.
It took us a little bit to recognize that when we went to edit it, I realized, oh, you can actually see them in the reflection. So we were able to use the clip, but I just had to punch in and like, you know, slide it over a little bit so they were out of frame. But that unedited clip, you could see the family in the reflection pounding on the window.
Dude, you got to throw that in the trailers. That seems like a compelling moment.
That's actually like a good thing. I didn't even think about that.
I can lie to people in the trailer. It happens all the time. That's why I don't watch them. So, now, you know, on film. Okay, for people who don't know, when you're doing a film fest and you're hosted on Film Freeway, you get submissions through, and you may have you normally have no contact with the person. And there's a lot of different avenues where they can write stuff in there. And I believe in some part of your profile, you put that you'd been stopped by the police multiple times making this movie. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I was imagining that you had the ski mask on in the day walking around like a suburb.
No. So like the ski masks. So we were very aware of like when I would catch myself in a reflection. And it's interesting because I'm like technically a lead actor in this movie, but you never see me. And you never hear me because the voice, I don't pride myself an actor. I want to be behind the camera, you know? So the voice is actually Nolan, my writer, because he is a really great actor. But so we were hyper aware of that. And in part three, you're going to see the face of this person. There's a purpose for it. And, I don't want it to be me. So I was like, okay, we need to make sure that we hide me as much as possible, so that people aren't going to recognize it. But yeah, so the ski mask we only had to wear when I knew I was going to catch myself in a window reflection or a mirror. And oftentimes we actually just cut around it anyway, because there was a lot more footage of me catching myself in a reflection, and we would just chop those parts out as we went along. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah. No, it's tough because when you're doing like mise-en-scene in a POV movie, you're gathering breadcrumbs narratively, and you start to imagine what people are reacting to when they see it. So when I heard that you're walking around in a ski mask, I'm like, does that mesh properly with the film? Cause I feel like in the early parts, he would have to be like blending in to society.
100%.
Yeah.
And there were a couple times where, we probably got a little too close to really stalking people. Like, we weren't, but, you know, we're just walking down a sidewalk filming at night, and suddenly somebody pops out of an alley in front of me. And I'm like, okay, I could just keep filming. I could just keep filming and make it appear that I'm stalking them. And actually, funny enough, a lot of that footage didn't make it into the movie for one reason or another. But yeah, there's plenty of footage of me just like filming random people, you know, and they still to this day have no idea that I did that. So I started to kind of creep myself out. and one of those times was a time that I was stopped by the police. They were very nice. I was able to like, hey man, just like Google my name. Like you can see, like I'm a filmmaker. I'm not, you know, I'm really not a creep, but I'm pretending to be a creep. And they were always, you would be shocked what you can get away with if you have a camera in your hand.
It's
crazy. Like people might question you, but as long as you're like, oh, I'm just making a movie, they're like, oh, okay, you know.
Yeah, a little bit of confidence. Like, remember when it was like a viral thing to bring a ladder to a concert? And what? It would be like two dudes would bring a ladder and just walk in.
No.
And then it's like, is anybody going to stop us? And people are like, they got a ladder. They're doing something. So they would just walk in and like prop it up and be like, oh, we're in the show.
Well, I knew a guy who stole a canoe because he just walked into a sporting goods store and just walked out with the canoe. No one questioned it.
Dude, we're in the Bay Area. That happens every day.
I'm just saying that, you know, they learned from the old school guys.
Yeah.
They've been doing this for a long time.
A little bit of confidence. You can get away with it. I mean, it is funny. I imagined you were walking around with like release forms in your back pocket.
I had a backpack with release forms. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you show that like the police are bugging you. You'd be like, hey, look.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you get any footage with them in it?
No, we actually didn't. There's some audio of somebody stopping and talking to me, but that's it. And
is there body cam footage?
I bet there is. Actually, you know what's funny is we have some footage that I didn't even think about when we were filming it, but so many people have like Ring doorbell cams and stuff. So we have a cute little like compilation of all the times that somebody caught me on camera filming at like a Ring doorbell or on their surveillance cameras. So we have more of that stuff than anything.
So part two opens up with a YouTube montage of an annoying vlogger covering all of your Ring doorbell camera, right?
No, but you're not too far off. There's like, there's a discourse about the first film being out there and people, you know, viewing it and some people saying it's art and some people saying it's smut. And yeah, so we're building out the world a lot more and like discussing the debate of like violence in cinema.
Well, I'm looking forward to it because I think that we need more found footage franchises.
Is that a joke?
No. Okay. No, I like because
they do well.
Well, I'm talking especially from the micro budget indie standpoint.
Uh-huh.
You know, look at what our Lord and Savior Nigel Buck has been able to do with the Bad Brand franchise.
Or Turner Clay with Blackwell Ghost. Turner
Clay with Blackwell Ghost.
Or Stephen Cognetti with Hell House LLC.
There we go. Aforementioned Dutch Mary.
Or VHS 99, 85, 94, 2038.
And so the story goes.
Those sons of bitches need to call me, man. I watched the newer one, and I'm probably going to get like so much. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I thought
I'm getting ready.
But I thought Scott Derrickson? I'm so bad with names. His segment was such a disappointment to me. And while I loved some of the aesthetics of it, it actually reminds me of what we're doing in Looky Loo. I just thought it didn't fit well with the VHS aesthetic of the whole thing.
Are you talking about the last one?
Yeah, with the dream.
I agree with Jason.
Yeah, he didn't.
I didn't like that one.
And it kind of felt like he was eating his own tail because in, is it Sinister? I'm so bad with titles. Yep. Okay. Like those 8mm film clips are some of the creepiest things I've ever seen in my life.
Yep.
I love that stuff. And so when I saw that, I was just like, this is like a less cool version of what you've already done. And it doesn't really fit with VHS. So I don't know. It made
Throbbing Gristle.
Yeah.
It made me really hopeful that like some people would see what we did and think like, wow, they committed to this and this is really believable, but I'm not Scott Derrickson. So I don't think we're going to get the same attention to Looky Loo. But
here's the thing. I think a lot of like studio filmmakers, they come at it almost as like, it's like Dogma 95 and they're like, all right, I'm going to tackle these rules, but I'm also going to break them. And I'm gonna do it in an interesting way. So you know that film deals with the dream analog projection. Oh hell yeah! See, that's so okay. What kind of film guy are you? Are you like you got a Criterion collection in your house?
Most definitely. I'm all over the place. Like I'm definitely a genre head. Like horror is my bag. That's my comfort food. But I'm all over. I really am. So like you know I love everything. Like right now I'm teaching a class on Tarantino and I'm not like a Tarantino stan or something. But I love everything. So, you know, my favorite movie of all time is American Movie. You know, Yeah, or like Birdman is one of the best films ever made, in my opinion. And so I'm all over the place. But horror, like, if you guys can't really see it, and I don't want to like jostle the sound too much, but like behind the laptop right now, I just have a wall of horror masks. And
okay.
Yeah, like my house is just full of horror memorabilia, and I have like the full size shorty from Killer Clowns from Outer Space on top of my piano. Like, that's kind of where I'm at. And I love cheesy, campy 80s horror more than life itself.
But you're not interested in making it.
Not especially. No. Like, we did a proof of concept trailer for this thing called Skate or Die. That's like supposed to be set like a film made in the 80s. And it's kind of like a Class of 1984 meets Thrashing, I guess.
Okay.
The idea. Yeah. So a lot of times we come up with those ideas that we're like, that's a lot of fun. And like, but I don't really want to invest the time in doing something that doesn't really say anything new. And like, I kind of felt like with Looky Loo, maybe we finally like, we're holding a mirror up to society and to true crime junkies. Like, and I want people to like, I want to be able to start a conversation with the films that I make. Sometimes I'm probably going to fail at that, but that's my goal. I don't want to just make some Killer Clowns knockoff. I'm not interested in that, you know?
Well, you know, I think the found footage culture, we're still pushing the boulder up the hill, but I do, it's so weird. It's still so like splintered on the internet. Like, I would recommend do not go on the Reddit. Like, I think the Reddit has made a full heel turn. Everybody on there wants free stuff. And it's not really about supporting or thinking about the genre. It's interesting when you deal with found footage, because horror movies, you know, they have a culture and everybody, they know what they're getting into. Where found footage, it's a big umbrella. And these movies can be completely different in every aspect. Yet there's a group of people who like to devour them. And I don't even think they really think about why, like why these movies are different. And honestly, I think the horror community is only like a little bit of the Venn diagram. I mostly think it's film fans who have the most fun, which is why I'm excited you're coming out. The Bay Area, we have a good film community, or we did. I think it's going to come back though.
That's nice.
Yeah. Dude, we've lost more theaters than other cities have ever had.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. But we still have a good community out here. And my favorite thing is to like try and bully all the, like, the film, not movie people to come out and be like, come on, it's the year. You got to come watch found footage, and having them be surprised. And I think you have one of the more thoughtful films. It's why we're opening the day with you. And I wanted to talk to you about that. A lot of people think that is a bad time slot. I think it's a way to calibrate the audience. Like, we want you to pay attention, wake up, because we're in it already. And as the night goes on, it should get easier. I just think that's the natural progression. So you're opening up, and dude, I can't be more excited. And thanks for hitting us up with the world premiere too.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's absolutely, we could not be more stoked on where we're premiering. So we are really pumped. That's why, like, as soon as we got selected, we started figuring out how we were going to get out there. Cause it's not the easiest for us all the way in Indiana and Lev's in Chicago, but we were just like, we know we have to go out there. And actually, I gotta be honest. I was just listening to some of your episodes earlier today.
No.
Well, I was cleaning the house, but like somebody just brought up Embarcadero. And I think you were talking about it as like maybe a theater or like an outdoor venue. Okay. But like my relationship to Embarcadero is because I'm a skate rat. So like Embarcadero Plaza is like where modern street skating was like born. So it's on my list just to go to Embarcadero Plaza, even though it's totally different now. Like, so I'm going to be nerding out a little bit over San Francisco just for stuff like that. Or like, you know, being like Tommy Wiseau.
Well, Jason, I'll tell you, I was at Embarcadero last week, and if you wanted to bring your skateboard out there, it's just you, the streets, and a couple of fentanyl zombies. And,
oh, great.
You could let a rip out there, man.
Yeah.
Dude, it's a ghost town.
Really?
Yeah. You know, yeah, the theater's shut down there. There's still a few shops and stuff there, but it's mainly just three giant husks of, you know, tombs that used to be, you know, thriving businesses.
Wow. But,
Yeah, I think we're due for the pendulum to swing the other way, though.
Punchline's still there.
Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm.
So weird. I don't know many people who are comedy fans out here in the Bay Area. Like, I don't know where they go. Or yeah, I don't. Yeah, so it's interesting. And yeah, you're totally right. A lot of those. Are you going to bring a board out here? Are you going to be shredding during the fest?
I was actually hoping I would go there and somebody would just have a skateboard. And I'll be honest with you, even though I'm a skate rat, I'm not a very good skater. So like, I'd probably be like ollieing and manualing and doing a couple shove-its just to be like, I skated Embarcadero. Like,
That's all you need.
That's what I did when I was hanging out with all my friends who could skate. I was like, oh, I'll bring a camera and that will be my role.
Oh yeah, for sure. That was me too. You know, I've always said
bombed like Lombard Street.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there's like some people, you know, a lot of people move out to LA and like, I didn't go that route. And sometimes I, you know, question if I should have a long time ago, but the main reason would be to actually try to get involved with just filming skate videos. Like more than trying to break into the industry, it would be just working on skate videos. That'd be a heavenly place for me. For sure.
Have you been watching modern skate videos like on YouTube?
Well, yeah, I basically every day, instead of going to like Google News like I used to, I go to Thrasher Magazine and just like see what's new. And I watch everything basically every day.
It's interesting how it hasn't changed, but I feel like it has. Like just the way it's framed, shot, edited. Like it's subtle. Like the vibe's still there, but I think about that a lot. Every now and then I'll throw one on. And you can just kind of feel how the craft has like elevated in a like film way.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of had to, but it's interesting because there are also companies like Zero Skateboards who like still shoot on the VX1000. Like they're shooting standard def and like, because they love that aesthetic, like that's what they grew up with. So they don't really want to, you know, switch over to HD. But then you have people like Ty Evans who are out there. You know, he shot a lot of like the Spike Jones stuff. And so yeah, he's out there shooting with drones and red cameras and stuff. It looks very different, the kinds of stuff that they're shooting nowadays. I don't want to wax intellectual on skate videos.
No, I love it.
We should probably get back. But honestly, that's where I got started. Like I just shooting me and my friends doing like jackass ripoffs and skate tricks, and then learning how to edit that to music, and slowly that snowballed into like, okay, maybe now we can go make a funny little short together. And it just all kind of kept, you know, the snowball kept building until finally we're making indie features.
Dude, you're going to dig David Dawson. Have you talked to him?
No. Who is he one of the filmmakers there?
He's one of the film. He directed Flesh Games.
Oh, okay. I got a very, just from that little screen grab and the title, I was like, is this like a Trash Humpers Gummo kind of vibe? Or I couldn't tell. You don't have to spoil it. I mean, I'm going to see it in just a few weeks, but.
No, I mean, it's like trying to nail down what the vibe of Gummo is. Like aesthetically, he's definitely influenced by it. Like a Joel Petrakis is really his lane. He feels like that. But yeah, it's kind of like a raw. This is filmed, you know, behind the picket fence where nobody knows what the fuck you're doing, which is kind of the appeal of that. And I don't know. I think y'all, dude, I'm so excited for this year. It's gonna be so tight, and we'll get to watch Trash Humpers in 35mm together.
I know. So I don't know if you can answer this, but did somebody buy that when Harmony was selling? Okay, I didn't know if that was one of those that he like sold the 35mm prints that were like painted by him or whatever.
There was a group chat going around where it's like we should have just fucking pulled it together and tried to get it. I think he was selling them for $7,000.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And he painted all the canisters. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
I think he had like 5 copies or something.
Did he do it or did AI do it?
No, it was him. It was definitely him.
Fucking around with his little robots now.
All right. You got anything else for him? I know we hit an hour mark, so I'm trying to be polite.
We did.
I would never let you go, Jason, if it was up to me.
I know. And fortunately, it's not.
I know. I can see.
We got to, you know, we got to maintain the title of this show.
Yeah. So, dude, I'm very excited for Looky Lou. For all you hard format fans out there. Again, what I mean, Jason, here, I got more homework for you. It's a hangman That's the ballpark I think you're in. It's called Hangman. Just watch that, go in blind, and you'll...
Then play it.
Yeah.
It's a fun game.
Blindfold yourself, put the movie on. Sure. But that's what I'm talking about. And you'll find that, you know, it doesn't get a ton of fandom. Also, it's not a franchise. Dude, a franchise shit. We got to make a found footage franchise.
The other thing is, like, we're planning a trilogy, but we've got it set up so that, at least in our minds, when part three is done and there is like there's a definite end to like this person. Our logic is that you can keep going. Why not? Mm-hmm. He could obviously have copycats and people that were inspired by what he did, and you keep the story going. So like, who knows? We'll see what happens. Our focus right now is just making part two so badass that people can't deny us anymore. But we really hope to just keep it going. You know, it's, I don't want to just be in the looky loo business, but we're very excited about this project and where it's going. So fingers crossed for it.
I just want to say, Jason, I'm very looking forward to the possibility of one day opening up my computer or scrolling through my phone and seeing that Looky Loo 2 is a thing. Because, that's a great title. Looky Loo 2? Electric Boogaloo?
Oh, I made that joke too many times. My writer's like, stop it. Stop making that joke.
You gotta do it. It's there. It's there. You got to do it.
No. Oh, that made me cringe.
I know.
My soul.
I understand.
Now, before we let you go, how can I track down your faux doc when I die?
I'll bring copies out for you guys, because you really can't. Like, it's such a weird movie and so dated. Like, you know, we made that in college. Like, that was kind of an experiment, you know, and we just used kind of the footage that I had from when I was a teenager. And like, we think it deserves to stay buried. Like, not that it's messed up and offensive. It's just so few people saw it. And it's kind of like a local, like only local people know about it or have copies. Uh-huh. And I'm just like, we're going to do a re-release of my horror anthology Night Terrors. And some people have said, you should re-release When I Die. That was an interesting movie. And I'm like, I just think the quality is so low, like literally the image quality, that I think people would be very like thrown off and they wouldn't understand. Like, did he take a step backwards? Was this just released? Even though we did it in like 2009 or whatever. So I will bring you guys copies. I think it's worth checking out, but it was also under a different production company. I've told this story before, but it's so silly. Like, Weird on Top Pictures comes from David Lynch's Wild at Heart.
Okay.
Laura Dern, This World's Wild at Heart and Weird on Top. That's where I got the name. And the first film company, the old iteration, we were STD Films. And dumb enough, it actually stood for Standardized Testing Days. And it was just like an in joke with my friends. But like, we did it in high school just to piss people off, because we'd wear STD Films shirts to school. We back when IMDb had like a thread board or whatever, like somebody was like, STD Films, really? And that was the day that Weird on Top Pictures was born.
Damn.
Beautiful.
That's all it took, one comment? Come on.
There was more to that comment that made me like pause and reflect. Because he basically said, no one's gonna take you seriously with a name like that. Which that was our goal at the time, was to not be taken seriously. And then we were like, maybe that's not a good plan moving forward.
Well, Jason, you know, you can't just put out there that the movie needs to be buried. These people are going to become ravenous. So if you're open to it, I would maybe bring a couple. We could sell them for you at the table or something. But people are going to hound you for that movie.
Maybe I'll bring some. I'll bring a few copies of that, and I'll bring some copies of Straight Edge Kegger. And if people buy Straight Edge Kegger, they get a free copy of When I Die. Maybe something like that.
Yeah. I'm in. I love it.
Look at him. He's already coming up with merch deals right now.
But please, any merch you got, bring them out.
I'll do my best. I'm going to stuff everything into a backpack and a little carry-on bag, because I don't want to spend all the crazy money, you know, with all the different bags and stuff. But I'll do my best.
And when you come out, bring something from Tinker House so you don't get a homesick.
Okay.
Yeah, bring that Blair Witch brick. So we can use it.
Jason, thanks so much, man. This was a blast.
Yeah, Jason, dude, I love you, man. I can't wait to hang out with you at the end of the month, too.
I'm so excited. Thank you guys so much for having me. This was a blast. I would, if you want to keep me talking for hours another time, I'm down for that, too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overlook Hour. And if you would like to hear more, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your podcatcher of choice is. And while you're there, go ahead and give us a rating and or a review, which is a very easy way for you to support this show that we bring to you every week for years now, free of charge. And as always, you can find us on YouTube at The Overlook Theater, Instagram at The Overlook Theater, Facebook at The Overlook Hour, and Twitter at The Overlook Hour. Last but not least, you can send us your emails and tell us how much you like or dislike the show at overlookhour@gmail.com. And if you're nice, maybe we'll read them on the show. I've been your engineer, Randy Statt. Please join me along with Clark, Russell, and Oksana again next time. Bye.